From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy, broadcasting this week from Monroe, Louisiana. This program is made possible in great part by the generous support of you, our listeners. We are so grateful for you. For more information on how you can keep this show on the air, please visit stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. On our interfaith calendar, August 26 starts the Jain observance of Paryushana Parva. At the intersection of religion, government, and politics this week, the Texas House ended a special legislative session ahead of schedule without voting on the horrific anti-transgender bathroom bill. The Republican speaker said the measure will not be a priority in future sessions. But haters take heart. Also in Texas, four female evangelical Christian prisoners are suing the Justice Department because they say being incarcerated with transgender women violates their religious freedom. Yes, this is what it has come to, friends. Naturally, the plaintiffs are represented by the Alliance Defending Freedom, the nonprofit legal group that's baked into every wedding cake and floral arrangement in this country. After the violence in Charlottesville, protesters tore down a Confederate statue in Durham, North Carolina. At least one was arrested. Meanwhile, Baltimore, Maryland quietly removed four statues that had been the subject of heated council debate for the past year. And Donald Trump's business council had so many defections, it had to be shut down. But it's noteworthy that not one member of his evangelical council of advisors has stepped down. Not one. Now, here's what's coming up this week on State of Belief Radio.
I think that a lot more people are going to die before we're done here, frankly. These people want violence, and the right is just meeting market demand.
It doesn't matter how deeply recent events have wounded white people of faith who love this nation and weep for the way the Trump administration has turned its back on so many of our core principles. African Americans have been wounded even more deeply. A strong message that thoughts and prayers are no longer enough has been coming from Pastor Mike McBride of the PICO Network Live Free Campaign, and we'll amplify that message on this week's show. It was inspiring to see a diverse group of faith leaders from many traditions gather in Charlottesville to stand against racism and hate. It was something else entirely to see that same group of faith leaders targeted by the white supremacists. Later in the hour, I'll discuss interreligious activism in this new age of hate with Interfaith Alliance President Jack Moline. But first,
not all of those people were neo-Nazis, believe me. Not all of those people were white supremacists by any stretch.
Former KKK Grand Wizard David Duke tweeted, "Thank you, President Trump, for your honesty and courage."
I worry about the journalists who are relentlessly covering this presidency. We don't yet know the long-term effects of focusing day after day on an Alice-through-the-looking-glass approach to reality and leadership. But having relied on the articulate work of investigative journalist Sarah Posner at the intersection of religion and politics for many, many years now, Sarah, welcome back to State of Belief Radio.
Thank you for having me, Welton.
Based on a lot of your writing in the last year or two, I suspect nothing has surprised you about the administration's responses to Charlottesville. Am I right about that?
Well, let me just say that even though the fact that white supremacists had planned this rally in Charlottesville didn't surprise me. When I got to Charlottesville, what was transpiring did surprise me. And that was partly because there appeared to be no effort or very little effort on the part of the law enforcement to keep the two sides apart. I had covered other events where, you know, there were white supremacists or militias or alt-right groups there and protesters against them, whether they be Antifa or other groups or individuals. And always the police made every effort to keep them physically separated from one another to avoid violence. And that didn't happen in Charlottesville. And that was shocking to me. Now, as far as the administration's response, I have to say that Trump's press conference at Trump Tower, where he just essentially gave a full-throated defense of the white supremacist position, was surprising to me. Mm-hmm. And it was a sign that no one can any longer make any pretense about trying to control Trump or rein him in or moderate him or what have you, whether that person is John Kelly or Ivanka Trump or Jared Kushner or Gary Cohn or whoever the person of the day is who is supposedly reining him in. We can no longer pretend that that is happening. And the subsequent reporting for that Trump Tower press conference, which was, you know, mad, mm-hmm. madder than anyone that he has given thus far, I think it was Maggie Haberman and Glenn Thresh reported in the New York Times that staffers were stunned that he said in public what they had often heard him say in private.
Yeah, that was telling.
And that was just so telling about them and him. The, mm-hmm. like, the moral monstrosity of these people knowing that that's what he really thinks and continuing to work for him. The idea that anyone thought that they could hold him back from saying it in public, particularly when I think it was in either Politico or the Washington Post, that he is like a caged animal.
Yes.
I mean, you know, these are phrases that are being used by people who work for the President of the United States,
right.
and they continue to work for him. So, yes, like, you know, there were certain elements of this that were surprising to me. Obviously, the fact that Trump is supported by and in turn supports white supremacists was not surprising to me. I have written about that for a long time.
Yeah.
But I think that we've reached this crisis point where everyone knows it. Everyone knows what's happening here. Yet the Republican Party is continuing to pretend like they can somehow get this under control.
Yeah. Knowing that you were in Charlottesville, what was it like? What did you see and what did you feel looking into the faces of those people who came to make trouble?
Like I said, I've covered events with some of the same or similarly minded people at them. So their views and ideology are not unfamiliar to me. Mm-hmm. I think that what was so frightening about Charlottesville is how unleashed it felt and how out of control it felt and how I felt like I had just stepped into a war zone. Mm. You know, it smelled like a war zone. It was just extraordinary. And I have lived in Charlottesville. I went to law school at the University of Virginia, so I lived in Charlottesville for 3 years, and it was just like, if I hadn't known those streets myself, I don't know what I would have thought. It was just extraordinary. It was, to me, I just thought, okay, I've covered, during the course of this election, alt-right, white supremacist, neo-Nazi events, rallies, etc., and this was just a completely different thing because of the violence and because of how heavily armed some of the people were. Let me just say that, like, in Cleveland, there were militia groups, much smaller, mm-hmm. Who had come out with a mind towards, you know, protecting Trump somehow. So, you know, that they came out in such numbers, I guess, was not surprising. But it was just sort of the scale and scope of how chaotic everything was and how it devolved into this mayhem. I thought that given my previous experience with law enforcement keeping the peace mm-hmm. without infringing on people's First Amendment rights to say what they have to say. I mean, you have a First Amendment right to speak, but you don't have a First Amendment right to fight in the streets.
Right.
So I think that that was what was stunning to me. Sure. And, you know, I have to say that I was covering and walking in the back of the group of people who were marching when the car rammed into them and killed Heather Heyer. I was in the back, so I didn't see it happen, but I heard it happen. And nobody knew what it was at first, and then when people realized it was just... I'm not sure that I really have the words. I mean, I wrote about it for Rolling Stone, but I still feel like I don't really have the words yet to describe what that day felt like and what that day means for America.
Sarah, why do you think so much of the media has continued to sort of give the benefit of the doubt to this president and his administration, always taking an approach of, if we didn't know better, this could be construed as racism? I mean, by now, we do know better, don't we?
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. I felt like this week that there was a little bit more letting loose in major news outlets with the use of language in terms of, you know, like, I think that the headlines, each subsequent reporting on Trump's reaction to Charlottesville, and particularly the reaction to his press conference on Tuesday, I think that many outlets were more forthright in their descriptions of what was happening. Mm-hmm. I think that the New York Times said something along the lines of the president of the United States gave a full-throated defense of white supremacists.
Right.
You know, and so I think that's very unusual. I mean, we haven't seen reporting like that even about Trump. So I do think that perhaps we've maybe turned a corner. Mm-hmm. And it also seems like Trump and Bannon right now are sort of turning up the volume in a way that will make it impossible for the media to not, you know, to not say Trump is embracing white supremacy. Mm-hmm. Trump's strategist is promoting ethnic and racial strife and maybe even violence. I mean, I hope that the mainstream media continues to use this forthright language to describe what is happening here. It would otherwise be irresponsible. I mean, the idea that he would say that there were some very fine people marching with that group on Friday night with the torches, while, you know, there's raw video footage from the local paper in Charlottesville, the Daily Progress, and anyone can watch it. It's about a 20-minute video, raw video taken that night. They were chanting, "You will not replace us, Jews will not replace us, blood and soil." I mean, like, the idea that you could see that and say that there were some very fine people marching with those people is just astonishing.
I'm thinking back to your Rolling Stone article earlier this year warning about the affinity for the alt-right you saw at the CPAC conference, for example. Uh-huh. You also identified how empowered the alt-right was feeling just by seeing Donald Trump nominated in the first place?
Yeah. I mean, I think it's been very clear for a long, long time that Trump has embraced, by turns, winked and nodded at and embraced these white nationalist and white supremacist groups. Now, let's also backtrack to before he ran for president and electrified these groups, mm-hmm. that he was the champion of the racist birther theory, that he was the champion of racist claims about the so-called Central Park Five, and had cheerleaded for their conviction. And it turns out they're innocent. He has never apologized for that. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there's a real mountain of evidence. But, like, I think to really understand the depravity of the way he thinks about race, ethnicity, religion, there was reporting that he was pressured by his son-in-law, Jared Kushner, mm-hmm. to walk back his initial comments about Charlottesville. Mm-hmm. And he told Kushner to forget it. Kushner's Jewish, but his grandparents were Holocaust survivors. So this man, you know, has a son-in-law whose grandparents were Holocaust survivors. The son-in-law pleads with him, you know, make a morally defensible statement about Nazis marching in the streets of an American city. And he told him to forget it. I think that's pretty telling about what's inside Trump's heart and mind.
I want you to talk about the overlap between political conservative Christians and the racist alt-right You've written about both, so I'd love to hear your thoughts on that.
You know, I wrote about this relationship or unplanned, perhaps not, coalition in the New Republic earlier this year. Mm-hmm. The Christian right has its own, you know, history with racism, as you know. Mm-hmm. One of their and very early and potent animating events was the IRS's revocation of the tax-exempt status of Bob Jones University over its ban on interracial dating. Mm-hmm. This was seen by the Christian right, by white evangelicals, as being, you know, a big bad government infringement on, you know, the religious freedom or the ability to interpret the Bible as they please by a Christian institution.
Mm-hmm. Right.
That history is still there. I mean, it was only very recently that the Southern Baptist Convention, for example, you know, has grappled with Confederate monuments and Confederate flags and racism within the convention itself. Mm-hmm. You'll remember that this year at its big annual conference, they at first did not vote on a resolution to condemn the alt-right, and it was only after an outcry that they voted to do that. Mm-hmm. And some very prominent Southern Baptists are still backing Trump, like Robert Jeffress of First Baptist in Dallas. And so, you know, there's that history there. And then you look at that history from the standpoint of these white evangelical, quote-unquote, leaders who are backing Trump no matter what. Mm-hmm. Backed Trump after the Access Hollywood tape came out, are still backing Trump after what happened over the past 4 days. You know, I mean, the whole series of things, they just, I think that they're so drunk with the power that they get to go to the White House and pray with the president in the Oval Office that they're willing to defend him no matter what. They might be his biggest defenders. You know, and when you look at polling data, mm-hmm. white evangelicals are by far his most supportive demographic group. By far.
Right.
They're also very happy that he's doing their bidding on policy issues, and so I think that they don't want to make any waves with him. They were happy with the Gorsuch nomination, cabinet appointments, with political appointees who are being installed at agencies to roll back LGBT and reproductive rights, and so on and so forth. Mm-hmm. So, but I think that you can't look at that without also looking at the history of white evangelicalism and race in the United States.
Right. Despite their denials, it's very clear the administration and unknown number of evangelical leaders are turning a blind eye to this surge in overt racism. I think it's clear that there are statements and policies that have encouraged open expression of hate and bias. But let's go a step further. Is there a chance, from your knowledge of people like Steve Bannon, that there is conscious encouragement of what we've been seeing, not at the presidential level maybe, but among the people surrounding him?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, Bannon, it's very clear, has been stoking this. And if you read Breitbart at any time under his leadership, it's clear that that's the goal of Breitbart, too, to fuel these sort of the strife and racial division and ethnic division and so on. I think that there are white evangelicals who are just fully on board with that. I think that there are white evangelicals who are dismayed or whatever adjective you want to use with Trump and all of this.
Mm-hmm.
But they are so intent on accomplishing their policy and legislative goals that they're willing to look the other way. But
yeah.
In the defense of anti-Trump evangelicals, I do know many who didn't vote for Trump and are just horrified, mm-hmm. horrified. Now, the question is, what happens post-Trump, right?
Yeah.
Will those evangelicals hold accountable the evangelicals who propped up Trump through all of this?
Yeah.
Remains to be seen. But I think that there are enough evangelicals who are propping him up and not enough who are opposed to it, who are speaking out about it.
Mm-hmm.
I have many talk to me in private,
yeah.
but they don't want to go public.
The Nazis and racists we saw out in force in Charlottesville have vowed to return. What do you think that means from your knowledge of these people?
I think that they will return. You know, obviously, if anyone's seen the video of the individual who was profiled in the Vice documentary about Charlottesville,
yes,
and then how he later became fearful of being arrested or what have you, I mean, I do think that there's a lot of cowardice among these groups. But I think many of them are bound and determined to come back and do this again. And they're bound and determined to blame the police for what happened. They're bound and determined to blame anybody else, aside from themselves, for how Charlottesville went. And so they're going to use the fact that it turned violent as a talking point for, oh, it was the police's fault, or it was the city's fault, it was the Jewish mayor's fault, or the black vice mayor's fault, that things didn't go well. And I have no doubt that they're going to try to come back. The University of Florida and Texas A&M University have just announced that they are not allowing Richard Spencer to speak on their campuses this fall, but I have no doubt that there will be First Amendment litigation over that. But all you need to do is look at any of the video of what happened in Charlottesville this weekend and see that these universities are completely justified in saying that they have a safety concern with having these speakers come to their campus.
Not as an investigative reporter, not as a commentator, but as a patriot who cares about this nation, what are you feeling?
Well, you know, obviously, I've never seen anything remotely like this in my lifetime. And I'm extremely worried, in large part because if we had a president who would clearly draw the obvious moral lines and take the obvious moral position, that wouldn't be empowering these fringe groups. I mean, he has, you know, made them more mainstream. He has brought them out of the shadows. They've always been with us, but he has gone a very long way towards normalizing them, and that's very worrisome. And something I think that we're going to be dealing with the fallout of long after he leaves office, for whatever reason he leaves office. On the other hand, I was incredibly heartened to see the number of people in Charlottesville who had come out, you know, completely peacefully, nonviolently to express their opposition to this scourge. And one of them lost her life. And many of these people were clergy. They were people who had organized with their church or synagogue to come out on Saturday. And that sort of thing obviously, like, gives you more hope that Americans are not going to stand by and let this happen. But I think that we're heading down a road where I think we're going to just see more strife. And I hope not, but I fear more violence. And it's some very scary times.
Sarah Posner is an investigative journalist doing invaluable work at the intersection of religion and politics. Her writing appears in Rolling Stone, The Washington Post, The New York Times, The Huffington Post, and in many other places as well. Part of the hard-hitting reporting she's been doing in partnership with the Nation Institute Journalism Fund. Sarah is the author of God's Prophets, Profits, Faith, Fraud, and the Republican Crusade for Values Voters. Sarah, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you, Welton.
There's lots more still to come on this week's show. Pastor Mike McBride says we must see white Christians reject racism right now. We'll explore what that would look like. And Rabbi Jack Moline will be back with us to talk about interfaith activism in an age of hate. If you miss any part of today's show, you can hear full episodes of State of Belief anytime on our website. You'll also find links to the topics we discussed this week, extended interviews and transcripts, and an archive of past shows, all of that at stateofbelief.com. I'm Welton Gaddy. You're listening to State of Belief Radio, religion and radio done differently. over the years, we've had many guests on to talk about books they'd written. We've hosted writers to discuss articles and blog posts. But I think this is the first interview sparked by an Instagram post. Pastor Mike McBride heads up the Live Free campaign at the PICO Network. When I read his words in the aftermath of Charlottesville, I knew we needed to have him back with us this week. And so, Pastor Mike, welcome back to State of Belief Radio.
I'm glad to be here with you, and thank you for always having me back.
Well, now, here's what you wrote. Don't need a prayer vigil. Already prayed up. Don't need actions either. Already acting. What we do need, white Christians en masse to reject white supremacy every day. Still waiting.
Yes. Yep, I think I wrote that at 2 or 3 in the morning after fire was shut up in my bones. Yeah, I think so.
What kind of response, if any, have you had to that?
Well, I have gotten, you know, mixed responses as always. I think there's some folks who thought that I was accusing white Christians en masse of being complicit or supportive of white supremacy. Interestingly enough, many of the responses from black Christian folks have been an affirmative, and some folks saying they're waiting as well. So I think that it's been mixed, but I still think it holds true, at least in our experience, that white supremacy can only function because white religious folks or, you know, white churches and white Christians en masse have not figured out a way to snuff it out. And so it's a cross that the American church in general, I think white churches in particular, have to carry if we're going to ever get over this very terrible and ugly principality that has taken root in our country.
Earlier in today's show, Mike, I mentioned that a number of the president's economic advisors have quit in protest. We've seen the military leaders go against what the president said, but not a single one of his evangelical advisors council has stepped down. Is that part of what you're talking about?
I mean, it's the most visible part for sure. It is indeed the case that white supremacy, racial hierarchy, is made intelligible to the general mainstream culture because religion, economics, medicine, sociology, science have all reified and re-inscribed white supremacy, whiteness, and racial hierarchy. And so without a repudiation, a denouncing, and then a disinvestment from all of these disciplines and sectors, if you will, discursive spaces, without a disinvestment from white supremacy and whiteness, then we will continue to see it operate both implicitly and explicitly. And so what we see with the evangelical constituency in this country, who arguably voted 81% in support of Donald Trump, we got to remember that almost 50% of all white religious folks voted in favor of Donald Trump. So we see that there is a certain kind of attraction to the kind of leadership that Donald Trump offered to the country previous to his election, and now post his election and his presidency, there is still an attraction to that. And we have to figure out, what is it about our faith, what is it about the way faith is practiced in the United States, that folks can still feel like they can follow Jesus and be a champion of white supremacy? That is, I think, a dilemma that the church in America must answer. I think some churches and denominations have already answered that, but the evangelical white church, I think, is finding itself wanting and proving themselves to be a false gospel. And I think we see a manifestation of that with these leaders who have not yet publicly called this president into account, much less removed themselves from his inner circle because he is unwilling to repent.
I'm not sure how many, if any, of the Evangelical Advisors Council you know, but it seems to me if they really are evangelicals. They would recognize that here is a teachable moment, maybe a transformational moment, to deal with the president on what's wrong with what he's doing and to use that as an example for other Americans to correct what's wrong in their communities. Why wouldn't they do that?
Well, I think it's always important to remember that white supremacy is also about power. So it's not just about, you know, racial animus that is interpersonal. It's about power. That's why we must remember it's racial hierarchy. It is about who gets to assign value, who gets to assign meaning, who gets to assign and ascribe power. And so I think the proximity to the president of the United States that many of them are afforded has seduced them. It has bewitched them, as the Galatian text says, to believe a lie. And I think they are deceived, if not just in a deep apostasy to the faith that has at least informed their historical tradition. And so I think they are probably unable to chastise or correct the president because they literally are so deceived, they see nothing wrong. And this is why I believe their gospel is a false gospel. And it is, you know, a reminder that all of us have to daily search ourselves and our practices and make sure that we are not complicit in the implicit principles and manifestations of white supremacy. And I think that is the larger question and larger challenge that I hope my post stimulates and catalyzes for folks. I don't expect large numbers of Christians to walk, march down the street with Ku Klux Klan outfits or white supremacists and white nationalists and neo-Nazi paraphernalia, but we are seeing that white supremacy, racial hierarchy is still embedded in our systems and structures, and there's still not enough of a massive resistance to this, whether it's through voter suppression, whether it's through the budgets that are being passed, whether it's through mass incarceration, whether it's through housing discrimination. That is a manifestation of white supremacy as well, and we don't see the kind of outcry that is necessary to dismantle that. And that is what I'm referring to when I mean that we need white Christians en masse every day to wake up and reject that form of white supremacy just as much as the white supremacy that marches up and down the streets in Klan rallies and hateful speech.
Mike, please talk about the experience of the interfaith leaders who were in Charlottesville last weekend. What happened at St. Paul's Church Friday night, and what happened in the streets on Saturday? I know you're close with Pastor Tracy and some of the other clergy there. Talk about that, please.
Well, you know, it proved to be a very traumatic experience for Pastor Tracy Blackman, Dr. Cornell West, one of our own staff inside the PICO Network, Felicia Johnson Yoda. She's actually from Charlottesville. Her mother still lives there. Her and another colleague drove down to be in Charlottesville, so we had a number of our folks there. I was planning to go, and I had to cancel my flight because of some family obligations, and so Pastor Tracy reached out to me right in the middle of all that was happening. Just communicating how afraid she was. It was a terrible, terrible text to receive to know that they had been surrounded in the church by these obviously agitated, loud, violent, white young people, mostly with torches and shouting that Jews will not replace us and white lives matter. This church was filled with a multiracial group of people of faith and no faith, just folks with moral commitments to ending racism and opposing white supremacy and the white nationalist movement. They were preaching and singing and chanting and embracing and building their spiritual power, as we always do when we're getting ready to go out and do acts of public witness and possibly civil disobedience. It is a ritual that we do to make sure that we are going out in radical love and not anger and hatred and variance towards even the systems and the stewards of these systems that we are often opposing. And so when they found out that they were surrounded by a mob of white nationalists and Klansmen and neo-Nazis. They were held within the building for their own safety. Many of them had to leave out a back door of a building and rush into cars after a pathway was made for them. And they had to drive through this mob. It was a terrifying experience for many of them. And I will never forget the voices and the pain that was told to me as we were talking over the phone. The next day, they proceeded to continue their commitment to be faithful and to be public expressions of love and opposition against this hatred. There were fights. There were skirmishes. The police department refused to protect the counter-protesters. They refused to rein in and control the mob and the neo-Nazi crowd, and lots of vandalism. Felicia Yoda from our staff found herself unable to go to her car in the parking lot because there were young men there with semi-automatic weapons waving them in the air around her vehicles with Nazi flags flying right next to the U.S. flags. I mean, it was a manifestation of evil that many of them will never forget. And and so this is where we are. This is what we have to, as people of faith, publicly resist, denounce, and use every tool in our tool belt to dismantle this evil that is, Pastor Tracy says, on his last gasp, trying to stay alive. And if we do not defeat it, then we will find ourselves moving to a time past. And this is, I think, the task of people of faith and goodwill in this moment.
Pastor Mike McBride is National Director for Urban Strategies' Live Free campaign at the PICO Network. He's also lead pastor at the Way Christian Center in West Berkeley, California. Mike, it's always great to talk with you. I hate it's under these circumstances this time, but thank you so much for taking time to be with us again on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you as always, Reverend, and God bless you to all of us as we resist this evil.
When the racists gathered in Charlottesville, wanted to generate maximum fear and dread, they targeted a treasured university campus and a historic church where diverse interfaith leaders were gathered for prayer. Those same leaders were targeted in the streets of the city the next day. This is something new. Even as some religion has been complicit in America's ugly history of racism, going so far in the opposite direction as to threaten faith leaders directly? Hard to even grasp. With me now is Rabbi Jack Moline, president of Interfaith Alliance and a longtime resident of the Commonwealth of Virginia. Jack, welcome back to State of Belief Radio.
Thank you, Welton. You know, I always enjoy talking with you.
What were your first thoughts as the news of Charlottesville started breaking last weekend?
Well, I have to say, my wife is an alumna of the University of Virginia. My daughter, Jenny, who was an intern for Interfaith Alliance, is an alumna of Virginia, and she works for Governor McAuliffe. So aside from the same sense of disbelief that I had watching CNN reports of what was going on back in the States, I'm talking to you from Europe right now, I was just distressed beyond belief because I know how precious Charlottesville and its history of tolerance is to the people who live in the Commonwealth. And this was almost beyond belief. Well, I happen to be today in the city of Vienna, Austria. And earlier today, I was standing in the spot looking up at the balcony where thousands and thousands of Austrians welcomed a newly victorious Adolf Hitler. Vienna is an exquisite city, Welton. It is a city of music. It's a city of culture. The architecture just oozes a sense of the higher aspirations of life. It is the home of some of the great minds of our generation, people who were nurtured by the rich culture here. And yet, the people went crazy when they felt they were being threatened, and they felt they were being threatened because that threat was manufactured from the top. I am more alarmed than ever about what I'm seeing in the United States. And please don't suggest that I'm comparing the president of the United States and the former dictator of the Third Reich. I am not. The phenomenon I'm looking at is a country and a culture with a rich depth of tolerance and perspective that went crazy because there weren't powerful, sane voices willing to stand up and say, this is not the way. Every faith leader in America has the responsibility to stand up in her or his pulpit and say to their congregants, this is not the way.
What does it mean that the moral authority of a broad group of interfaith leaders seems to have been completely ignored by the racists?
It means that when you have a true believer in any ideology, that facts and reason don't matter. And that's what we're dealing with here. Well, you and I thought we were dealing with ideologues in government for a lot of years, and we understood how difficult it was to bring them around to a rational and tolerable understanding of what pluralism means in this country. But I never seen nothing like this before.
Yeah. Would you talk about how Interfaith Alliance has responded to these tragic events?
Well, we've been reaching out to our partners across the spectrum, both inside Virginia and outside of Virginia. And, of course, we've joined a chorus of voices that have called for calm, that have called for mutual appreciation, that have called for human dignity, and that have urged the leadership of this country, and particularly the President of the United States, to step up and do the right thing and make sure that the folks who are responsible for this mess are marginalized. It's been frustrating, and it's been hard, but we're working on it.
In your work with lawmakers, what is your sense of how seriously they take the threat of white supremacy and anti-Semitism in our nation?
My sense is that on a personal level, it is probably the case that most of these legislators are well informed about what constitutes the real terrorism in this country, which is not some manufactured sense of foreign invasion, but the extremism that has been cultivated right here in the continental United States. I think they take that very seriously on a personal level. My sense is that as you move farther along toward the conservative end of the political spectrum, that there are no votes in that kind of conviction, perhaps until now. And particularly people who find themselves in the majority in both houses of Congress right now have been reluctant to go up against people who are laying claim to being part of their base. Now, I know Republicans better than to think that they are pandering to the radical right, at least the racist political right, but they also know that votes are precious these days, that margins are slim, and they have a terrible moral dilemma right now, as well as a practical dilemma. I hope they make the right choices.
Many Congress people have responded to this horrendous tragedy by denouncing the racism, the alt-right, all of those things. But none of them, maybe one or two, Lindsey Graham being one of them, has actually said the president has to do something here. We've got to say to the president, he's not doing the right thing. He's hurting our nation. What do you think it's going to take for members of Congress to give up on a tone-deaf Donald Trump when it comes to this issue?
Well, I think what it's going to take is an indication that supporting the president is an electoral liability. I have not a lot of confidence, particularly that members of the House of Representatives who aren't already opposed to the president's actions are going to risk their seat by coming out against the president if they have a sense that their population still supports him. So I think it falls, frankly, to the people who have the most influence in those districts over what people think. And those are not political leaders. Those are the faith leaders in those communities, the teachers, the local politicians, to wake up their constituents, their congregants, their parishioners, to the moral imperative of making sure that this country continues to conduct itself with its best aspirations in mind, not its basis aspirations, which seems to me to be what the president is representing right now.
What role do you see for Interfaith Alliance as tensions and divisions continue to grow, and how can our listeners get involved?
We, like everybody else, well, and I have to tell you, we're scrambling. I've been already in conversation with some folks in Virginia about what we might do on a very local level in all of the legislative districts to begin a conversation across the chasm that has formed between people far to the right and people far to the left. What Charlottesville illustrated for us is something much deeper than political disagreement and, frankly, even than faith disagreement. The entire future of our country rests on being able to maintain the values that have allowed us to disagree without being enemies. And so if people are interested in having these conversations across political boundaries, across faith boundaries, Interfaith Alliance stands ready and willing to help. And if you're willing to organize something in your community, if you're listening out there and that's what you want to do, please let us know, and we will help you get the resources to get that started.
Rabbi Jack Moline is president of Interfaith Alliance, Defending True Religious Freedom. Jack, thanks for taking time out of your travels today to get in touch with us. It's always great to have you on State of Belief Radio, and to be a partner right now is important more than ever. Thank you for being here.
Thanks.
Before we go, my friends, I want to talk with you, but I'm in an unusual situation because right now, I really am not sure what I want to say. On the one hand, I want to speak quietly and talk thoughtfully about calmness, patience, and encouragement. We have been shocked. Our nation has taken a blow to the gut. Our jaws have dropped. Our hearts ache. We have seen an ugly picture so gross that it is almost unbelievable. The streets of a good city in Virginia, governed by a mayor who talked with us on State of Belief just a few shows back, has been violated, with their stated goal being to, quote, unite the right. Privileged but angry citizens of a free nation attacked the city, marched on innocent residents, shouted anti-American slogans, threatened clergy praying for peace and justice, threw the language of hate at Jews, people of color, and all who wouldn't march with celebrants of neo-Nazism, Ku Klux Klan members still seeking a nation committed to white supremacy, and anti-Semitic demonstrators. Local civic rights activist Heather Heyer died in this mayhem. And instead of being shocked back to humanity by that tragedy, the racists mocked her in social media and got busy organizing ugly protests for her funeral. I found pain-laced encouragement and blood-stained hope in the words spoken and the behavior demonstrated by Susan Bro, Heather's mother. This courageous woman mixed her terrible grief with a commitment to carry on the work that stemmed from her daughter's vision of a better America. God bless this grieving mother. God bless also the hundreds of courageous Americans who took to Charlotte's streets in recent days, not with torches but with candles, singing hymns and defying the hate that engulfed their community like so much hot lava from an erupting volcano. Now, since those quieter moments, however, my search for calm, comfort, and prayers for peace has transitioned into disbelief. And my disbelief has turned to anger that penetrates into the marrow of my bones. Not so shocking, but certainly sickening, the President of the United States has taken the side of the troublemakers, saying they were no worse in character than the people in the city who sought to quell the nasty assault of the haters carrying torches and displaying their desire for atrocities against anyone who is not white. Donald Trump forfeited his presidential authority and demonstrated his stunning lack of morality by lending his support to those who disdain the diversity and justice that give greatness to our nation. It was impossible not to notice that news coverage of political leaders demand the president act more fittingly, quoted exclusively Republicans. There were so many of them that no Democratic voices were needed. Among the unforgettable moments was the sight of two African-American commentators on Fox News, one a leading GOP strategist, literally in tears over the significance of this administration's failings to so many American families and family histories. Look, for a long time now, we have known that Donald Trump does not understand the U.S. Constitution and the importance of religious freedom, and his supporters did not care. He was not disturbed by the heinous behavior he directed toward women. His bias for white Christians, his disrespect for Jews, and his apparent hatred toward Muslims. And neither were his supporters. Truth has been cheap for him. Lies have sprung from his lips several times each day. Trust in him has been erased. Except for his supporters, of course. Evidently, like those bigots he is protecting and defending, he doesn't believe that all people are individuals of dignity and worth and deserve equality. Oh, I wish right now I could talk with you about the promise of democracy, a restoration of justice, the power of love, though not the kind of love the president speaks about so ignorantly, and the land of the free. But the vocabulary of democracy has been trumped by a vocabulary of hate. The words on the minds of concerned Americans today, right now, are alt-right, a term that identifies a racist who embraces the ideology of white nationalism and anti-Semitism, or the word cuck, an insult used by the alt-right to attack the masculinity of an opponent, originally other conservatives, whom the movement deemed insufficiently committed to racism and anti-Semitism. Or the words social justice warrior, SJW, used disparagingly by the right as an epithet for someone who advocates liberal causes like feminism, racial justice, or gay and transgender rights. Or the words blood and soil, a phrase from 19th century German nationalists that connotes a mystical bond between the blood of an ethnic group and the soil of their country. Now, all of these people and others pledge to follow what they call the 14 words, a pledge spawned by notorious white supremacist David Lane, quote, "We must secure the existence of our people and a future for white children." Millions and millions of Americans were shocked when Donald Trump won the presidency. The fact that so many did not realize that his odious message would appeal to so many of our neighbors proved how ignorant we had become of people who see the world differently. Many of us were living in denial until it was too late. The exact same thing goes for the self-pitying, tiki torch-bearing Trump fans who marched on Charlottesville. They've been out there all along, but we didn't or didn't want to see them, and now we no longer have the choice. My friends, we're not now talking politics. We're talking morality. Nothing less is at stake than the conscience of our nation. Competing with each other are the historical moral values of our nation versus the hateful values of white supremacists, alt-right proponents, neo-Nazi values that thousands of Americans have given their lives to try to defeat, and actual members of the KKK. Our president has shamefully shown us that his choice is to stand in support of the values of darkness and destruction. Now it's time for the rest of us to make our choice. This imperative to take a moral stand extends to staff members in the White House and every member of Congress. They, like us, have to choose the values with which we will identify. There's no compromise here. There is no middle ground. Each of us will choose, and our choice will be evident in our actions. There were many white supremacist actions planned for this weekend across the nation. By the time you hear these words, God only knows what else will have happened. The philosopher Karl Popper famously said, "If we extend unlimited tolerance even to those who are intolerant, if we are not prepared to defend a tolerant society against the onslaught of the intolerant, then the tolerant will be destroyed, and tolerance with them." It is tragic that we must once again weigh carefully those words. But it is unthinkable what the consequences are likely to be if we don't. Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. If you've made a donation to State of Belief this week, I want to say a sincere thank you. If you've heard something on this week's show that you think would be helpful to someone that you know, please share it with that person or persons. Direct them to stateofbelief.com, where they'll find full episodes, an in-depth archive, extended interviews, transcripts, and links mentioned in the show. Be sure to follow us on Facebook and Twitter and engage in the discussion. Our producer is Ray Kirstein. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. And be sure to join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.
It's time we stop. Hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down.